my room has got two windows, but the sun never comes shining through. You know it's always dark and it's dreary since I broke it off with you. I live on a lonely avenue, lonely avenue. Girl wouldn't say I do it. So sad and blue.
I could cry, could cry, could cry. I could die, could die. And I live on a long avenue.
Oh, good stuff. John Batiste has a new album out. It's called Big Money, and we'll be playing tracks from the new album as our bumper music this morning. It is, again, called Big Money, John Batiste, and we'll have the playlist. The playlist is posted online, wamc.org/roundtable. Good morning, all. Welcome to Tuesday, the 26th of August, and to our program, 13 minutes past 9 o'clock. We are honored that you are with us and decided to spend even a scant of a second to be in our company. We are, again, honored and glad you are here. We hope you can divert your attention long enough, to inform you, to entertain you, or maybe just to scare the hell out of you. We don't do that intentionally. It's just seems to be a chain reaction. All right. Let me introduce the group to you, and we'll get started. And again, we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. Stuart Rice, Honorary Chair at the University of Massachusetts Amherst College of Information and Computer Sciences, and Faculty Associate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Fran Berman is with us. Hello, Fran.
Hello, Joe. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
On the John Batiste front, there's a fabulous documentary about he and his really accomplished partner, Zuleika Jawad, whose book on journal prompts I've been reading, Book of Alchemy. And the documentary is called American Symphony. And it's great. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's really poignant and wonderful and interesting.
Yeah, I have seen it. I actually got to interview the director and John Batiste. It's an amazing piece of work.
Yeah. So, and let's try not to scare anyone today.
No, we won't do that. But that is your department.
Wow. No one ever told me that when I signed my no money contract with you.
Always good to have you here, Fran. Thank you very much. We also welcome Professor of History and International Relations at Vassar College, Robert Brigham. Good morning, Robert. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. Great to be here.
Wonderful to have you on the program as always. You know, it's never, never good just to have one person from Vassar when you can have two. Associate Professor in the Department of Sociology at Vassar College, Catherine Tan, is here. Good morning.
Good morning. Welcome. Thanks for having me back.
It is a delight to have you here. It is never good to have just two people from the Poughkeepsie area when you can have three people from the Poughkeepsie area. And we welcome our good friend Mark Whitman to the program, investment banker on Wall Street. Good morning, Mark. How are you?
I'm good, Joe. You know, I'm also an honorary member of the Vassar community since my wife.
I'm going to move you to five. There you go.
Am I up now?
You're up now. Yes. Your wife
is faculty there.
Yes, faculty. Vassar. So you degrees of separation.
Sometimes they let me on campus before they find out I'm a banker, and sometimes my visit is curtailed.
Well, you and your wife are responsible for many of our Vassarites being on the program, so we thank you very much for that, and it's good. Yesterday we had a room full of Bard folk, and today we have a room full of Vassar folk, so this is... these are all good things.
Hey, and UMass too.
That's right, and UMass. Yeah, we need a whole contingent from UMass over as well.
Yeah,
you work on that, friend.
We should have all these colleges like fight each other.
I know, it's like battle battle of the network stars. All right. Well, good morning, all. Welcome to the program, and let's get started. There's much news to be had, and we will make our best to, I would say today is a wallow day. We'll wallow our way through what is going on. So we begin with the fact that the president of the United States announced last night that he's firing the Fed governor, Lisa Cook, opening a new front in his fight for control of the central bank. Trump said Monday night he's firing Lisa Cook, an unprecedented move that would constitute a sharp escalation in his battle to exert greater control over what has been considered an institution independent from day-to-day politics. Trump said in a letter posted on his Truth Social platform that he is removing Cook effective immediately because of allegations that she committed mortgage fraud. Cook said Monday night that she would not step down. President Trump purported to fire me for cause, quote unquote, when no cause exists under the law, and he has no authority to do so, she said in an emailed statement. I will not resign. Bill Pulte, we just said this, right? Bill Pulte, is that what we came up with? A Trump appointee to the agency that regulates mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac made the accusations last week and alleged that Cook had claimed two primary residences, one in Ann Arbor, Michigan, the other in Atlanta, Georgia, in 2021 to get better mortgage terms. Mortgage rates are often higher on second homes or those purchased to rent. Trump's move is likely to touch off an extensive legal battle that will probably go to the Supreme Court and could disrupt financial markets. Stock futures declined slightly late Monday, as did the dollar against other major currencies. Our markets will not open for another 11 minutes. All right. Mark Whitman, we'll begin with you.
Well, I'm not going to. Am I on? I can't
you
hear
are
myself.
On.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm not going to go too deep into the cause issue. I'll let others talk about this. But economists have long warned that politicizing the Fed will undermine its credibility. It'll push up borrowing costs for the United States government and for all of us, directly and indirectly. It will threaten the dollar stability, and it will threaten global stability in financial markets, particularly in times of crisis. So the headline here is this is a really bad development. It's not all that surprising that Trump is taking these actions. He certainly signaled that he was after the Fed to have a more accommodating monetary policy. And this is a piece of what he's done, whether it be with educational institutions, other parts of the government. So nobody should be really surprised here. The key is for Trump to control the Board of Governors. And with the recent resignation, or I guess it's technically a pending resignation of one of the boards of governors, Trump was one person short of controlling the Board of Governors. If indeed he replaces Cook with somebody who is an acolyte, he will then have control. And with that control, the Board of Governors can de facto decide what the U.S. monetary policy is, both in terms of interest rates and, from my perspective as a monetarist, even more importantly, how accommodating it is to growing the money supply in the country. It can also appoint the chairman of the board can appoint a lawyer, which could more broadly define the powers of the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, which would probably allow them to do things like threaten swap lines. Now, swap lines is a fancy term for when the United States government, in a time of crisis, lends money to other foreign governments to try and stabilize international financial markets. It was used, for instance, during the financial meltdown, also used during COVID as well. And if those lines were not readily offered in a time of crisis to countries that needed it, it could severely dampen accentuate the degradation of markets and cause really expensive developments within those markets. We've already seen now the interesting developments thus far is the market seems perturbed. But not it's not yet freaking out. That's a technical term.
Freaking out.
The short-term interest rates have fallen under some expectation that the Fed may, if things develop the way people fear, that the Fed may be more accommodating lower short-term rates. But the Fed is sort of like an individual pulling down on the branch of a tree against the tree, hoping that the leaves at the far end of the branch come down. And the leaves at the far end of the branch are actually – those are long-term interest rates. And those are determined really by the market's perception of what's going to happen in the long run. A lot of times you'll see short-term rates and long-term rates move in sympathy when the Fed takes action because the Fed is basically substantiating suspicions that the market has about the long-term economic prospect. But that's not always the case. When the Fed in the past, even as recently as 2022, thinks that short-term rates should be lower and the market thinks otherwise, it will go ahead and put the interest rates for the economy as a whole. It will continue to trade those where it thinks they believe, even if it's higher than where the Fed has them. So this whole issue of Donald Trump sort of trying to control rates via the Fed is illusory. It doesn't work. As a matter of fact, Nixon was somewhat successful, if you talk to historians, about putting pressure on the then chairman of the Federal Reserve. And although there was a short-term sugar rush to the economy, most historians agree that it actually deepened the recession and the stagflation that followed in the 70s. So this is, again, sort of at best, Trump's going to get a short-term sugar high. But the market forces will rightfully determine where rates are. The sad thing is once you have degraded credibility in a financial institution like the Fed, it becomes expensive to all of us, and it takes a long time to curate that reputation back.
So I'm curious, and I find this interesting as to whether she's really fired or not. So the president says he's going to fire her, and has fired her, and because of using a mechanism saying that he has cause, and many people say, well, that's legally dubious, but I don't know how you prove it that mortgage fraud compromised Cook's ability to perform as an effective financial regulator. So now she is saying, I'm not going anywhere and I'm showing up for work in the morning. So I don't know how that works.
Well, guess where we're going to argue this out, Joe.
Well, I understand that part. I understand that part. It just all seems very awkward in the meantime.
Yeah, well, look, she technically hasn't been found guilty nor admitted to breaking any laws. And it's not even clear that if she broke this particular law, technically, that's a crime. Adam Schiff can tell you about that. He actually there's an instance. Adam Schiff said he was had a primary residence in two places, but there was a paper trail that said he had told the lenders, my family lives in one residence and I in the other, so they effectively are primary residents two at the same time. So it's not clear she broke the law. It's not clear if she did, it matters. And it's not clear that even if she is convicted of having broken this law, which she would have done before she was on the Board of Governors, that doing so represents cause to remove her. And the courts are going to have to sort that all out, frankly.
And one of the wild cards in all this, I agree with Mark's assessment here completely. One of the wild cards in this is that the second residence in Georgia is actually a condo. And so they can be treated somewhat differently in the paperwork, and the lawyers will fight that out. But again, yeah, it's not so clear. However, I'm greatly relieved that the director of the Federal Housing Agency has nothing better to do than to look at the renovation of the Federal Reserve building and then look at the applications of one of the Board of Governors, that there's nothing else on his desk to do other than this. This seems like just a monumental witch hunt and a waste of time and resources.
Well, Bill Pulte, he's just a henchman. That's how I'm seeing this, because Trump tapped him to lead the Federal Housing Finance Agency, and since he's been in, now he's gone after Lisa Cook. He went after Adam Schiff. He went after Letitia James. Like, they have basically a hit list, and they're kind of checking them off one by one. This accusation, as Mark pointed out, like, we don't, there's no evidence. These are just allegations. And even if they found her guilty of claiming residency in two locations, is that enough to have her removed from her position? I mean, I definitely don't know. But this just seems like thug-like behavior. And to your point, Bob, aren't there other things they should be doing?
Fran Berman.
Yeah, I don't know that I had, you know, anything new to add here. I think that's right. We don't know the facts of it. Did she actually do something wrong? If she did, you know, is that cause? Can he fire her? I think you guys have articulately said all of that. What this makes me think about is sort of the bigger picture, is that Trump is a master at figuring out what the levers of control are and using them. I mean, this is something he has gone through the federal government, as far as I can tell, with a fine-tooth comb, and really figured that stuff out. And by and large, he seems to be using all of those levers to bring revenge and conflict of interest and greed and a bunch of other things that I don't circumscribe to a fine art. And so if you step back and look at this, you know, this is one of, you know, dare I say, we're all kind of getting used to this. Another misbehavior, another person on the revenge list, another thing that somebody is doing that he doesn't like, and he's going to bring the axe down on them. But, you know, other people do these things, and it's fine because they agree with him. You know, it's all part of the bigger picture, which I and many of the people that I know just find tremendously discouraging. So if you're talking about today as a wallowing and depressing day, you know, I guess there's a way to get into that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, we can wallow with that for a long time. So yeah. We are, I know everyone in this room is chomping in the bit to get in on this, and I welcome it. We're just going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will get to everybody's thoughts on it. We also welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org, as we talk about the firing by the president of Lisa Cook and her saying that she will not step down. We will continue that conversation and much more, plus your letters after this short break.
But am I really trying? This may be.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Fran Berman, Robert Brigham, Catherine Tan, and Mark Whitman making up our stellar group this morning. And we welcome you, panel, at WAMC.org. We are talking about Trump saying he's firing the Federal Reserve Governor Lisa Cook, and Lisa Cook saying she will not step down. Robert.
I wanted to echo something that Mark said earlier. I mean, since the Fed's establishment in 1913, it's been an instrumental part in making the United States a good bet for investment of all kind. Capital likes the transparency that the Fed offers. It likes the independence that the Fed offers. And so meddling here is going to attack that vision that capital and investors have about the freedom and about the openness and transparency. I mean, having hard data that's reliable from the Fed is one of the hallmarks of the American economy. So it seems to me that this is really a dangerous gambit by this administration to try to cook the books in the way that they are. The other thing that naturally leads to, and we were saying this before we actually came on the air, is, you know, the courts used to be the guardrails on all of this, and now you can't trust that, and that's a travesty as well. So I just think I see, you know, as a historian, I just see one bad historical moment after another piling up here.
We're wallowing. Go ahead.
I was going to say, Trump and his administration, like, this is consistent with their hypocrisies, right? So Trump had have been charged with, have been found to inflate the value of his properties in order to secure more favorable loans, right? And he was also convicted of like 34 charges, relating to covering up the Stormy Daniels case. Like, he is a felon, and everybody knows he's a felon. He's been convicted. And so it's just extremely frustrating and infuriating to see him go after Lisa Cook in a way that, you know, I have to point out, like, this is, you know, there is something very racially charged about this as well, from my perspective, right? And I think many would agree that, you know, Trump cannot handle the idea of successful Black people, of successful people of color. This feels very much in line with his attack on DEI and, you know, how he went after Obama when Obama was president, how he went after Kamala when she was running against him. And also, this is reminiscent of the way the right went after Claudine Gay at Harvard, right? And so they're pulling up these accusations that we have no evidence of. And the accusations, I mean, this is not, you know, going back to what Mark pointed out earlier, this might not be enough to get her have her lose her job over, right? So they're using these really small, I don't want to say really small, but they're using these from, you know, what I see as like somewhat minor offenses to create this large disruption. And it's really hard to not highlight that these things are, you know, racially motivated.
I would just like to, you also look at what is being done in the takeover of the cities in the National mm-hmm. Guard, and that those mm-hmm. many of those mayors are Black women.
Absolutely.
To start with, so yeah, and add that to the list.
Going mm-hmm. after Chicago, Baltimore, New York, all of those are Black mayors.
Anything you wanted to add?
No, I guess it's amazing to me how much pressure Trump has put on the norms of our institutions. I actually consider myself pretty well informed on the Fed, but I didn't realize that although the Federal Reserve was established in 2013, FDR and Truman had been largely successful in putting pressure on the Fed during World War II to offer an accommodating monetary policy. And it was as a result of that, later in Truman's presidency, there was actually a Federal Reserve Accord that really establishes the way that the Federal Reserve now works in its independence from the administration. And technically, that's not even a law. It was an agreement between a branch of government and a sub-branch of government. And now Trump has learned how to put pressure on all of these norms, not only within the Fed, but in other places. The one thing I would say that this highlights is that until and unless we change these norms, those involved in our government, and I'm not blaming the victim, but I am saying we need to be cognizant of the fact that we need to make sure all our I's are dotted and our T's are crossed. When I'll give you an example. When I saw that they were searching John Bolton's home and office, my conclusion was, well, if John Bolton has so much as a fortune cookie that he shouldn't have in that home, he's responsible because he should have known Trump was going to come after him. Now, when Cook was appointed, should we argue that the administration that appointed her should have checked her mortgage records? That seems to me a bit of a stretch. But heretofore, and for every appointee from now on, I think there's a very different standard that we need to operate under if all of these norms are going to be exploited by a would-be authoritarian.
But they're going to find something if they are doing a deep dive on their enemies.
I get that there's a lot of things to find, but I can tell you, and again, I am not blaming any victims, but I know of people who are licensed by the federal government and have to stay out of any trouble with the federal government in order to keep their positions. And on this exact same topic of primary residency in two places, went through a lot of hoops in order to protect themselves. And Adam Schiff clearly was one of them, another one of them. So again, I'm not blaming any victims. I'm just saying the standard of conduct, if the standard of conduct is going to be to the letter of the law plus, then people better get ready. And if again, if John Bolton gets caught with so much as a fortune that he shouldn't have, they can throw whatever book at him they want because he should have known. Frankly.
No, it's a great point. I do think, though, one of the things that that annoys me about all of this, though, is we thought we were done with these people. We wrote these people out of season two, Chris Christie and John Bolton. Like, they were gone. They were done. We weren't going to worry about them anymore. They were out. Their political fortunes had curdled, and here we are again talking about them and investigating.
Oh, but there's a real irony there, which is that had we gone right from season one to season two, the evil masterminds would not have nearly have had as much time to plan out the diabolical plans that are unfolded in season three. We, as a country, we are in many ways worse off because we didn't roll into season two of the Trump show as president. We took a break and let them plan their comeback.
But in soap operas,
go ahead. That's not right. This kind of thing is done by everyone in politics. They take the laws, they take the scrutiny, they apply it where they think it will most advance whatever goal they have. To me, the thing that's really different about this particular Trump administration is he is masterfully using the same approach everybody else used with reasonable guardrails. He's taken the guardrails out. He's doing it. And as far as I can tell, his motivation has so little to do with the public interest, you can't see it from there. It has to do with greed. It has to do with revenge. It has to do with power. It has to do with control. But other politicians use these things too. They're not as good at it, and they're not as mean about it. And so, you know, we shouldn't talk as if, you know, Trump is the only guy who's ever used this. People have used this since time immemorial. Our entire legal system is based on sort of figuring out which facts support your case, because there's a lot of ways to look at reality. That's not to say the legal system is a bad system, but that's just the way people operate.
Bolton probably wouldn't have been asked back for season two, but after the summit in Alaska, he has been nonstop on the news, and so and obviously very critical of his former boss, and so I think that, you know, that's the itch of the day that Trump wants to scratch. So there he is.
We have letters. I want to get to those, and there are many. So what we'll do is we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll go to the letters and continue this conversation. Then we'll move on to other issues. We welcome you, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'd love to hear from you. We will return right after this.
You got it figured out, who we are and what we can be. When we give without doubt, coming and going, we reap what we're sowing on time like a tambourine. Older and younger, you don't have to wonder what you mean to me, yeah. All my love.
Back on the roundtable panel, go to letters now, and we welcome yours, panel@wamc.org. We begin with Sally, who says, it scares me that one, Trump keeps coming up with new cruel ways to destroy us with no concerns about the short or long-term outcomes. Two, Trump's decisions seem to be based on personal retribution. Three, Trump's cohorts seem to encourage his bad behavior. Four, there are no people with backbone within the Republican or Congress to stand up to him. Five, Trump may be a puppet for someone or group of people with horrible intentions. Six, Trump is being controlled by another nation, Putin, question mark. And 7, how will we ever recover, or will we be able to, which is really 7 and 8 put together. So that is from
Joe. Can I comment on that?
Of course.
I think it's a really interesting letter, and I want to thank the reader for sending it. And, you know, 2 things strike me. Number one, this notion that Trump is super controlled. I mean, he's, you know, influenced by lots of things. But rather than sort of his own ego or his own flaws or his own whatever, you know, by another group or another country. So I'd like to hear some thoughts on that. That's not what I've been thinking myself, but I'd be interested in people's thoughts on it. The other thing is about, you know, how we put ourselves back together. And I'll tell you that from my own thinking, you know, Humpty Dumpty fell off the wall. But Humpty Dumpty wasn't uncracked before. A lot of the systems that he's, you know, seemingly randomly or meanly or, you know, whatever, thought to control, were not working perfectly before. And to me, I think the long game is really not how do we put them back to how they were before, but how do we create them for the same purposes they were needed for in a better way. And I'm thinking about my own, and I know a lot of the other panelists, go Vassar, I guess, are also involved in the educational system. You know, it wasn't like education was doing perfectly before. You know, we're parochial, we've had a lot of problems, we're certainly under the gun economically, and we have been before, and we're certainly under the gun now. I mean, there's lots of things that one can discuss about the educational system, but how can we sort of now move into another era where the educational system is stronger, where we're dealing with some of the problems that we've had both brought on by Trump and, you know, brought on in other ways. And so I don't really think it's a matter of figuring out how to put Humpty Dumpty back together. I really think it's a matter of thinking, you know, what can we put on the wall that can sit there and not break as badly when something happens. And, you know, to me, that's really the goal. The goal is not to just redo everything, you know, like it was on January 19th.
Anybody else on that?
I mean, I really like that optimistic take, because my go-to reaction is, oh my gosh, we're setting some terrible precedents here. And, you know, we know that the system was already, you know, broken. You know, it was not working perfectly well. And then Trump is showing us the extremes to which we can really destroy and break things apart. And I like your perspective, Fran, that perhaps, you know, after this administration, the next one will learn something from it and create guardrails against these things. But I'm also incredibly fearful that what's going to happen is politicians are going to realize, oh, wow, these are the limits, huh? Like, we've really pushed the boundaries and have changed or have moved the threshold for what the public is willing to tolerate and exploit that.
And I guess
I think the whole world is different now, and that's something that we really have to think about. How do we navigate in a world where we're all, I don't know, you know, numb, overwhelmed, delighted? I don't know. Are some people delighted? I'm not. But, you know, there must be someone who is.
You know, I guess as a historian, I'm naively optimistic because we've been in dark places before. And even on the other side of the aisle, I don't want to make this analogy complete. You know, history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme. And, you know, if 1937, if we took a snapshot of the United States, Roosevelt is in the middle of a court packing scandal. He's going to lose both houses of Congress and not lose, but he's going to lose major seats in both houses of Congress in the 38 election. To talk about a third term would have been unthinkable in 1937. His New Deal programs were not being that effective in many corners of the world. 1938 hurricane came through New England, changed every Republican to a Democrat because of the way the WWW and the Civilian Conservation Corps responded. Roosevelt rebounded. I just have, you know, history works that way. I have enormous faith in the creativity of the American people and civil society that we've created alongside government in these institutions that are now under attack. So I'm not ready to go to season three yet.
Look, I'm hopeful, but I think we ought to be careful. I'm not hopeful because there's a nefarious factor like Trump working on it. If you read, for instance, Harvard's own assessment of its issues around the protests and how both Jewish and Muslim and other students felt on campus, it's a pretty sobering assessment that they performed on themselves. And I think if you give them enough time and leash, they get at it. I don't think they're going to be any better off in fixing the problems that they face because Linda McMahon and Donald Trump are involved. So I am a big believer in the restorative value of many of these institutions in our country generally, but I don't think we should for a moment excuse the evil that we're seeing brought upon this country by this administration and say in some way, you know, maybe the flowers will bloom afterward. It's not because of them. It might well be in spite of, but it's going to be more difficult.
All right, back to the letters we go and check in with Kathy. I think that Trump is just the mouthpiece for Project 2025. I don't think he has the sanity or energy to figure out all the steps he's taken in this administration. Yes, I think he's evil, but I think he's also a puppet. And by the way, the almost entire Republican Party is one big puppet.
Oh, I think that, by the way, is another when we talk about delaying his presidency until season three, I think it's clearly the case that the number of Republicans who had a conscience who have attrited away during season two has made Trump far more successful and powerful during this third season than would have been the case.
I don't like maligning puppets. Then we go to Lance, who says the allegations of mortgage fraud against Lisa Cook are just another turn in the bizarro world of MAGA rationale. So we're supposed to believe in the veracity of such claims when DJT's intention to defraud through overvaluation was recently reaffirmed by a judicial panel, even though the financial penalties were reversed? Question mark. That from Lance. Then we go to Kim. I'm feeling like the more Trump tries to take over the country as a dictator, for example, pushing his enemies, fraudulently earning billions while holding the office of president, the citizens will rise up in protest. Do you think it will go as far as a civil war to stop him? I'm extremely worried about the next election, knowing he's doing everything in his power now to ensure that he stays in office one way or the other. Comments, panel?
Oh, God, I wish people would collectivize. Mm-hmm. I think as a society, as an American society, we're still far too fragmented, right? People are still far too divided along class, race. You know, and we see this in our elections. And I think we, you know, as a Democrat, I feel like we have a long way to go in pulling people together. You know, we are far too fragmented as a society to hope that one day we'll have some great movement to stand up against Trump. Now, that would be great. I mean, I remain cautiously optimistic and hopeful, but I don't see that happening anytime soon with how things are.
When I think of the deal that I assume the electorate made in the last presidential election, I think it was the fact that, and it was summed up by the Washington Post had an interview with a woman who said, I know who Donald Trump is. I understand his shortcomings, to summarize what was said, but the economy's horrible and I'm sending my son to college and I need the money. And I think nothing that Donald Trump has done has improved a lot of Americans economically, and there's much that he's done that will degrade it over the intermediate to longer term, including all these shenanigans with the Fed if he's successful. And I hope that that's the ultimate regulator on where he gets to, and the fact that, and who follows him in the next election, frankly. And also the Democrats have got to hope that that's that the ill effects of Donald Trump's policies start to show for the midterms, and that they can navigate some of these political gambits that he's playing, for instance, around crime in the country. It's not clear the Democrats have that capability, but we'll see.
Anne writes, oh, the irony of Trump accusing someone of mortgage fraud, dot, dot, dot. We go to Alice. Trump goes after another black woman. Lisa Cook hopefully will prevail. Whether Trump succeeds or not, he is once again bypassing what we now quaintly call due process. And then we check in with Brian, who writes, does anyone else see the irony of Trump convicted of fraudulent financial dealings firing Ms. Cook because of allegations she may have committed fraud? Does that make her better qualified to be, oh, president of the United States? When will this insanity end? And then we have a letter which is seems to be off topic, but admittedly so. I apologize if you've already discussed the purchase of 10% of Intel stock. I would love to hear why. Where is the funding coming from, i.e., where is the U.S. budget? Where in the U.S. budget? What CEOs and stockholders think of it? Mark, do you want a quick bat at that?
So Donald Trump basically said that the CEO of Intel should be fired. Called the guy into his office. They didn't, and then ended up with a 10% stake on the company and a call on another 5%. The 10% stake did not come out of the budget. It was in exchange for the promised, but in some cases as yet unspent subsidies that Intel and other chip makers are being given in the country. So in simple answer to the question, it wasn't an exchange of cash. It was an exchange for allocated, but in some cases yet unspent funds. It's a horrible idea in all sorts of ways that we could get into later, but that's the simple answer to the question that was posed.
With that, we will take that and pause. We'll take a break. And when we come back, we welcome you and we'll continue our conversation. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. New topics coming up right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Listening to John Batiste and his new album, Big Money, providing our bumper music for this Tuesday morning. We welcome you to the proceedings. Panel at WAMC.org if you'd like to get in on the conversation. Mark Whitman is here, investment banker on Wall Street. Catherine Tan, associate professor in the Department of Sociology at Vassar College. Robert Brigham is professor of history and international relations at Vassar. And Fran Berman, Stuart Rice honorary chair at the University of Massachusetts Amherst College of Information and Computer Sciences. You know, Fran, during the break, my buddy Mark Whitman said, you know, I bet Fran has some thoughts on Intel and what they're up to when it comes to the 10% and the federal government. Is that true?
I do, although Mark probably understands the economics of it all better than I do. But in some sense, although I know it isn't from a political and influence perspective, you know, separation of the market and the government should be a little bit more like church and state used to be. Not anymore, I guess. But I don't know. I don't think, especially because I don't trust the motives, I don't think it's good to be putting your thumb on the scale. Then I asked so this is a longer thing, Mark, and I would be interested in your thoughts. Maybe I didn't mind so much when Obama was helpful to Detroit or when we helped banks. But this one, I don't know. The motives make me think twice. I don't know. What do you think?
I think the defense for helping Detroit and helping the banks was because we had to. We were in the middle of a financial crisis, and they needed the capital lest they go bankrupt. In the case of the banks, it would have torn a hole in the global financial system. So everyone sort of held their nose and did what they had to. In the case of Intel, and this is what I'm curious in your perspective, Fran, is TSMC has an incredibly inordinate percentage of the highest-end microchips in terms of their ability to manufacture them. And the thought, part of the thought, the justification for what the administration has done, away from the vagaries of Donald Trump, is that we really do probably as a country need to have an alternative, because if China ever does walk across or float across the Taiwanese Strait, there'll be lots of economic consequences, but access to high-end microchips will be one of the most significant very quickly. So my question to you is, if you believed that you wanted to solve for that problem, does what the government did with Microsoft, taking a 10% stake in the equity, get you any closer to solving that? I don't see the argument for it. I was curious if you either believed in it or at least could articulate what the argument was.
Mm. Well, I mean, one of the things that I would add to that messy mix is that there's also the health of the market. Like, one of the things I've been looking at is, you know, what's going to happen in this Google case? Are they going to have to, you know, separate out Chrome or, you know, do something about that? And it has to do with sort of big and little. If you look at tech right now, the big companies, of course, the Magnificent Seven, whatever, are just making buckets of money, but they're also sort of crowding out everyone else. Part of that is because tech is just expensive. You know, there's, AI, which is like the Trojan horse for all tech these days. If you're not mentioning AI, you're somehow irrelevant, which I have opinions about also. But, you know, if you think about AI, if you want to be really successful around AI, you're thinking about big, large language models, which can run a long time and use a lot of energy and be used in your product to be more accurate or more whatever. And those things are very, very expensive. They're very, very resource intensive. They're the things that only sort of big, wealthy companies can do. And so if you think about the market for new innovation in AI, you think about other kinds of tech, data, all of that, it requires a lot of money to do it. So if we help the giant companies stay giant and completely dominate, it's a really different landscape than if you have sort of a healthy landscape with sort of big and little diverse kinds of companies. And so, you know, I wonder in my own mind if sort of putting your finger on the thumb of the scale for Intel, does that really, help the economy in the long run in terms of how many companies could be in those kinds of businesses? If this business about Google being perhaps a monopoly, and perhaps, you know, that maybe is a step in the right direction. It would change the landscape of tech if they had to give up their data or they had to jettison Chrome or something like that. So I think these things are really complicated, but in my mind, my own goal would be to have a healthy economy where the private sector could be the private sector, compete, where new companies could come. And of course, my own interest always is that there should be more things in the public interest, which is, you know, an economy sink, but something that we need to do.
Anybody else on that? All right, let's move on. Thank you, Fran, for taking the the extra step, the bonus question, if you will.
The bonus question, yeah.
Let's go to other topics. I would like to talk a little bit about the National Guard, which we've been discussing quite a bit on the program over the last several weeks. However, you look at this in its entirety now of Trump ordering major expansion of the National Guard's role in law enforcement. This comes out of an executive order released yesterday directing the creation of specialized guard units to quell civil disturbances in each state and seek civilian volunteers to assist federal agents in Washington. That addition to what we have been talking about seemed important to dive into this morning. The president directed the Defense Department to take a larger role in domestic law enforcement, including by quelling civil disturbances, as he threatens to broaden deployment of the National Guard in cities run by his political enemies. The executive order released by the White House on Monday morning also formalizes the creation of specially trained National Guard units in the District of Columbia and all 50 states that can be mobilized quickly for, quote, ensuring the public safety and order. The Pentagon did not immediately respond to questions about the order, which came 2 weeks after Mr. Trump declared a crime emergency in the District of Columbia and deployed National Guard troops to the nation's capital over the objections of local officials who have said crime in the city is at its lowest level in decades. In a statement, the White House said the president was ordering, quote, common sense measures to ensure long-term safety of our nation's capital.
This is a disaster on two fronts. One, it's upending 50 years of what the Guard's function is inside our military. Creighton Abrams made the National Guard an operational force in 1973 at the same time we moved to an all-volunteer force because of the Guard's role or lack of role in Vietnam and because of the role that the Guard plays in helping create a full and frank debate when this country's about to go to war. Abrams understood that a drafted army was in dire straits in Vietnam, and that was one of the major factors to move to an all-volunteer army. The Guard is not trained for policing. It shouldn't be trained for policing. This executive order is overturning 50 years of the way in which the Guard has been incorporated into a military-ready strategy. It's not their responsibilities. The U.S. military is purposefully established now and has been for 50 years so that you can't fight without the Guard. Abrams, Schlesinger, a whole host of others in defense in 72 and 73 thought that that was one of the problems, that you went without the Guard. So the Guard mobilization and full operational facilities inside the military has several functions. It's part of the democratic process. It's required for military preparedness. They're not suitable for domestic law enforcement. They're not trained for that, and we shouldn't want them in our cities doing domestic law enforcement. They have critical roles to play in defense, in the footprint of our defense forces. And no executive order is going to overturn that. You can't just, through the Guard system, if he wants to create a separate policing setup, he'll have to find another avenue. But through the Guard, this is just a horrible idea. It's a bad idea for the cities. It's a bad idea for the military. And it's a bad idea for democracy.
The idea that these specialized units will be specifically trained and equipped to deal with public order issues. My first thought is, what counts as order? What does safety look like? Who is defining these things? Well, Trump is trying to define these things. And he claims that it's common sense, but this is not at all common sense, right? The idea of safety and order by Trump's vision is an authoritarian, like, dictatorship, right? It is order under his terms and how he sees fit. And we know that Trump is extremely hostile towards these democratic cities or democratically led cities, homeless populations, disenfranchised populations, people of color. And so when deploying the National Guard and all of these new officers into cities, what he's looking to do is control populations that he finds problematic. And these are American citizens who have not done anything. And just looking at how he has has operated ICE and have deployed them to take people off the streets, like people who are just trying to earn a living and provide for their families, who have no criminal record. Like, just looking at how he has approached immigrants already, this is really concerning and dangerous. Having all of these officers on the streets is not going to make people safer, right? It's going to create an air of paranoia. It's going to create a sense of lack of safety for a lot of people, especially communities that have had a really complicated relationship with the police. This is, you know, it comes back to who is this for, and who is this sense of safety that he's trying to cultivate? You know, who is he catering for? And it's who is he catering to? And in these democratic cities, it is a retaliation against the citizens and the residents of these places. It's not for the people who are living in these cities. And he's going after, and we had mentioned this earlier, he's going after cities, mentioning New York, Chicago, Baltimore. He's in D.C. now. Like, these are places where the mayors are Black. And that is not a coincidence that he's picking and naming these specific cities first.
Mark.
So I want to talk about the politics of this, and I want to say I'm not blaming the victim, but I think we have to realize that Trump is doing this in anticipation of the midterms. This is a political move on his part to try and put wins on the board. And I think the Democrats' initial response was poor. I think it's getting better, but I have some suggestions. First of all, quit it with crime is down. If your citizens don't feel safe, there's too much crime. And you could probably say that about any city of size in the United States. So the mayor of whatever city it is should stop quoting statistics and simply say, you're right, we would love to further reduce crime and make our citizens more safe. Then the mayor of whatever city should say, that's not by having people stand around with big guns. We did that after 9/11. And we didn't stop a single terrorist. And if you want to talk about people feeling safe, you have to be smart. Because if you're a minority or the father or mother, let's say, of, in my case, a young African-American man, I and he don't feel any safer when there are people with big guns looking for things to do on the streets of this country. We bear the forces, the police forces that we train to perform that job barely do it sufficiently or arguably do not already. But if I were this mayor of a local city, I would take my list of open jobs, starting with the most highly paid and having the lowest paid at the bottom, and I would tip it upside down. And so I would take the job that's the lowest paid job that I need filled. And if that's somebody in the cafeteria to serve the police officers lunch when they come in at noon, I would say to Donald Trump, if you want to deploy the National Guard and help my city reduce crime, I've got a list of jobs, and we can slot these people in for 30 or 60-day slots, and here we go. Let's all reduce crime. Now, by the way, President Trump, if you say in the case of you and the Congress, in the case of D.C., weren't withholding $800 million of our own tax money from us, we would have filled many of these positions and be further on our way to reducing crime. But if you want to do it by lending me the National Guard, let's go.
Right. These are resources that could have been channeled towards like social services and get at the root of what causes crime in cities in the first place. A lot, I feel like a lot of this is not for the cities themselves or to protect the residents of these cities, but it is for all the Americans, all of his supporters outside of these cities. This is an effort to create to maintain his image as a tough on crime president for people who have no idea what life is like in these cities. But by sending in the National Guard and sending in all of these troops, you're creating these really vivid images in the news of, you know, people on the streets. And when you see officers on the streets, ironically, you think, oh, this is a dangerous place, right? These images of the National Guard deployed in D.C., their presence implies that it's a dangerous place. And so you have people in places in you know, outside of these cities believing that what he's doing is, well, one, believing that what he is doing is effective in some way, and two, reinforcing their image of cities as being dangerous when it's much safer in cities. Like if we're thinking about like crime per capita, it's safer in cities than a lot of rural places.
I think that's really right. I think if you think about the purpose of these people, ideally, which is to help us, that's not how you feel at all. I mean, you feel like, you know, they're trying to catch me doing something wrong. And, you know, in this day and age, as we all know, almost everything can be interpreted as something wrong. I mean, the other thing that just seems, besides the fact that, you know, to me, this all seems, it's the same theme. It's control. It's, you know, trying to present yourself in a particular way. It's like all about you. It's really not about what we need. And the other thing I find pretty ironic is, for the most part, now the National Guard are part-timers. They're folks who have other jobs. You know, they have a dry cleaners, or they're an accountant, or they work in a bank. And one weekend a month, or maybe a couple of weeks a year, they do something in the National Guard. Unlike law enforcement or even ICE, they're not trained to be full-time and to understand the specifics of the job in a way that's more professional. They're not. They're part-timers. And they're doing something that I imagine and would circumscribe to them that they believe is very patriotic for their country, and it's great. And when we've had National Guard, when there are real crises, they've been really, really important to those crises. But these folks are part-timers, and just sort of hauling them out in their uniforms just to make it look like you're controlling things, it's part of the many things I don't get about this administration.
I will say that the image of the National Guard that most Americans have are, you know, they're helping out with flooding, or they're helping out in some kind of way locally. But since 73, when they've operationalized the force, it really has taken on more of a lethal responsibility. It's fully integrated through their MOSs into the normal force structure. So they're not trained for any, you know, they're not trained for policing. They're not trained for those kind of civic functions like we probably have in our mind. They're a part of the force, the main force of the United States now, and even more so with reservists.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we will navigate the last half hour of our program. We welcome you to join us for any questions that you have, any comments you'd like to make. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. The only thing keeping us between you are the messages forthcoming and news from the BBC.
This is how I know. Let it go. You can lean on my love when there's no one to hold you. I'll lift you up. Never run.
Seems like we ticked David off. He writes and says, having the National Guard roaming cities does not make one think it's a dangerous city. It makes one realize that we are now living in a police state. Start calling by what it is, people, not sugarcoating it by casting it as a crime problem. Come on! That's from David.
I think I got the tone right.
Yes.
Yeah, it was like a very performative. It was great. I was going to say something weird for me is that I was in D.C. on 9/11. At that time, I was in San Diego. I was running the Supercomputer Center, and I had gone to Congress to talk to people about what we did in supercomputing. And it was supposed to be a one-night trip, and 9/11 happened. And it was like a one-week trip, and I ended up driving back from D.C. to San Diego because there was no way to get a plane. It was with some other people. It was a lot. But I remember during the time I was in D.C., of course, the National Guard were everywhere. And even though I knew I wasn't a terrorist, truly not, it didn't. The way in which the National Guard show up when people are going about their business, not when people are rioting or, you know, a lot of other things. It did not feel safer to me. It felt, you know, like I was had to mind my P's and Q's all the time. It felt it was scary. So I know my own reaction comes from that experience. And yeah, if something is happening and people are throwing bottle rockets and, you know, the more law enforcement, the better, to, if they can be helpful. But yeah, it didn't feel great.
Well, no one enjoys surveillance, whether you are out committing crimes or not, right? It's like when you're driving down, say, 87 to get to Albany, and there's a cop, and you know, oh, okay, well, you're driving, you know, somewhat close to, or I'm driving somewhat close to the speed limit. I still get really tense up and like hit the brakes, even if I'm already at like going at 65. But surveillance is not something we want to normalize. And the person who wrote in is absolutely correct. This is, it's not a slippery slope to authoritarianism. It's already here. Right. And it's expanding.
Yeah, I just want to caution you about broad brushing surveillance. I love my privacy as much as you do. But in fact, I was just working on this chapter in my book the other day. It sometimes surveillance is intrusive and sometimes it's protective. You know, sometimes we welcome surveillance because we believe it does make us safer. Sometimes we have surveillance of our own. You know, if you have a Nest thermostat, or you have a camera on your pet or your elderly relative, you've actually created your own surveillance. So I agree that surveillance is really problematic for privacy. But I do think that there's lots of different situations where surveillance is used, and you have to really evaluate them for what they are.
I think for this circumstance, you know, having this level of surveillance is problematic, and it creates a certain type of society that not only becomes used to it, this top-down federal surveillance system, but as you pointed out yourself, it changes people's behavior, and not necessarily for the better, and not necessarily in ways that would reduce crime. You know, like it, in some ways, it actually drives things further underground.
Yeah. I would agree with that, actually. And if you look at surveillance systems in countries that employ it much more than we do, China's a really good example. Mm-hmm. It isn't that there isn't some freedom of speech, but it really is underground for the most part, because it's really against the kind of control that the government is trying to maintain. Mm-hmm.
All right, let's go to David. I vehemently disagree with your panelists who suggest that the Democrats should stop talking about how crime is down and the cities Trump is militarizing. On the contrary, I think Governor Pritzker's press conference yesterday was a brilliant display of how to articulate the hypocrisy of Trump's policies by comparing the crime city crime rates in states with Republican governors with those of cities and states of Democratic governors. Why is he not sending the National Guard to those cities? I think we said that.
Yeah, maybe there's a disagreement a little more subtle. I heard much of, but I didn't hear all of Pritzker's press conference. I thought he's handling it better than most. I think you can obviously make the point about why Trump is picking the places he's sending them. But the one thing is, as a Democratic politician, I don't think you ever want to get hung out with the statement that the public thinks you're not worried about further reducing crime if there's a reasonable way to do it. That's just not where you want to be politically. And I don't think you have to be there in order to stand up to Trump. Again, if I'm a local mayor, I might sue the administration and tell them I don't want them there in court filings. I might draw a yellow line on the corner and say, if you're going to be here with guns, you got to be behind this line and just stay here and do your thing. But I wouldn't say I don't want to reduce crime. I would try to think of more effective ways to use extra bodies over a 30-day period, but it probably wouldn't involve I wouldn't let them carry guns in my city. There are two issues with that. Number one, the forces we train with guns are barely trained well enough. in this country to handle our culture? And secondly, if God forbid some of these folks are involved, these National Guards folks are involved in an incident that leads to harm, the moral hazard is also something that they haven't been trained for or prepared for. And so the consequences here are pretty serious. But again, politically, I just think the initial response of the Democrats saying, well, crime's down in D.C. was the wrong answer.
Well, so I was just looking this up right now. If Trump really wants to be tough on crime and go after cities with high crime rates, the top three of cities with highest crime per capita, violent crime per capita, are Memphis, Cleveland, and Toledo. And I wonder why they're not getting the National Guard sent on them.
Well, right. And but this broader conversation and what we're talking about, though, I mean, there were a couple times where the president did say, you know, all 50 states. And so I think it seems like it's going to be willy-nilly no matter what.
But it's not willy-nilly because he's targeting Democrats. Yeah.
No, I know. But I was interested in opening. I was interested by the fact that they seemed to open up the conversation that at least it was going to be something that could happen. It was like he was adding to the fright factor. You know, like you're not scared enough. But just so you know, this isn't only this could also happen in your town as well. And meanwhile, people remain to be more upset about the Cracker Barrel rebrand.
Right.
Can I take it just a little different tack on this, Joe? And that is, I mean, this is an executive order that he wants to, in a sense, create special guard units to now police domestic cities. Every one of the service branches except the Marines cannot meet their enrollment targets. National Guard numbers are low. Where is this training going to come from? We don't have the infrastructure and the bodies to do the jobs that we have need to have done right now. This is just adding another level to a system that's really under tremendous stress already to meet its function. This is just a bad idea.
Well, wasn't he providing like really strong financial incentives to get more people to join ICE? So I imagine we might see something similar to that, right?
What you're talking about in a special unit of a National Guard is actually preparing someone for foreign conflict and domestic conflict. Where are you going to get the trainers for that? Where are you going to get set up? You're going to have to set up entirely new basic training boot camp. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is not cheap, and we don't have the bodies to do this, nor would we want to have the bodies to do this. You should separate these functions. The National Guard has a military function. And if you want policing, give the cities the resources that you're withholding from them now. And I think that's another part of what Mark was saying earlier, which I agree with, is that if you're just focusing on this crime number, flip it around and say, well, if you had paid us the things that we have in our budgets and we're requesting, we would be able to meet the social needs of our people a little better. I think you can go on the offense on that a little more.
I think this requires a kind of foresight and strategy that he is just not capable of or functioning with right now, or rather I should say his people are not thinking of right now. This is about midterms, and this is about creating an impression right now and going after democratic-led cities. But I think you're right, Bob. Like, you know, we as of right now, we don't have the capacity to build the National Guard up in this sort kind of way and using them in the way that Trump has planned. However, he's not thinking that far in advance, and it's to create an image and a way to punish Democratic-led cities.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up the show and a couple more topics we want to get to. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Last moments on this day, Tuesday, the 26th of August, and we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. last call for letters. We are going to move on to, hopefully I'll be able to get to two topics. We'll see how well we do. And if we make it, great. And if we don't, it's my fault. All right, here we go. We go to, I want to talk about some international relations and where we are. We'll begin with South Korea and the meeting that took place between the president and South Korea. The president criticized South Korea's political conditions on social media, but in a meeting, he avoided tension. It was a meeting with the South Korean leader after a public blast. This was just hours after suggesting on Truth Social that the United States might stop doing business with the country. It was the latest Oval Office meeting this year that threatened to leave a world leader on his heels in an encounter with a president who has a penchant for both drama and settling scores. Ahead of the president's arrival, Trump expressed apparent displeasure with the process by which the president rose to power this year in South Korea, winning an election in June after the previous president was impeached and removed after briefly declaring martial law. Stir, mix, enjoy, Bob.
In Trump world, there's clearly not a firm grasp on many of the subtleties in international relations or in foreign culture and history. But for some reason, South Korea seems to hold a special place in this president's heart. He seems to know the least about it, and it is confounding to me. We know he loves Kim Jong-un, and in fact, right before the meeting, he praised Kim Jong-un, both in social media and in the press. But again, like some of the things that Mark was pointing to earlier, if we just look at what Trump does and not so much what the language is coming out of these press conferences with these joint leaders, I mean, it's really not a consistent policy. I mean, the number of troops and American troops in South Korea is declining in the Trump years. Camp Humphreys is in need of significant improvements. There's nothing there. Trump's saying that the United States wants to own all the land around U.S. bases in South Korea right now as the bases themselves start to atrophy. So it's just another example of him just not having a firm grasp of the facts that he needs to go into these kind of high-stakes, high-level meetings. South Korea is an incredibly important ally. Part of the Pacific Rim crescent that the administration should be focusing on to counter anything that China has in mind. And if I was Taiwan, I would be watching this meeting in the White House with a great deal of trepidation.
I have a question for you. They had a interview in the New York Times about somebody analyzing Trump as a negotiator, whose point was that he actually isn't a bad negotiator. He uses empathy in a tactical way, not in a more authentic way. And my question about his negotiation style is he seat of the pants for the most part? You know, is he just sort of operating out of the moment? How prepared do you think he really is when he goes into these negotiations?
I don't think he's very prepared at all. And in fact, I would say this whole idea that negotiations happen between personalities is somewhat problematic. You may get a short-term gain, but long-term sustainable agreements need big teams to work out details.
Yeah.
And his basic geographic and historical and cultural understanding of why the United States has a relationship with South Korea and why it's important for us and why you probably shouldn't praise the dictator
right.
in North Korea just before your meeting with South Korea, and the kind of commitment the United States has had over the last 70 years in South Korea. It's an important commitment, and all of that just seems to wash over this president with no effect.
Well, I mean, all of that has very little to do, in fact, the opposite to do with sort of greed, control, power, you know, those kinds
right.
of things,
right.
which, you know, in my mind, not a therapist,
and no inside information, it's just striking how much I see that being the motivator for everything I can tell he's doing.
It's interesting. It's a fascinating question because I was talking about this during the break, but did the president intend during the executive order signings yesterday to talk at such great length about CARP? I don't think so. I mean, that does seem like seat of the pants, like it was just a stream of consciousness, and all of a sudden he started talking about flying fish and the air that they're taking, and we have to get rid of this invasive species. And yet, would there be, you could make a point that you rattle the cage on Truth Social and say these things about South Korea as you're going into a meeting in South Korea, and then you are nicer than expected, which does seem to be more planned.
You know, that might work in some environments, but in international relations, things don't really work that way. We're talking about huge structures and long systems, and it's not really as personality driven. These are structures that are, you know, have deep history behind them. So I'm not sure that Trump's you know, art of the deal kind of approach to international relations. If I was a South Korean leader, I'd leave that meeting. I'm like, what am I supposed to do now? And if I'm Taiwan, I'm nervous. The least thing that you want to do in international relations is create doubt. You want stability. You want predictability. You know, you don't want a tweet on True Social that says X and then a meeting that says Y. That's just not good.
Oh, look, I want to answer this question. Donald Trump sucks as a negotiator.
Tell us what you really think, Mark.
And I can prove it. There's not one agreement
Let's hear it, Mark.
Agreement from his first administration that he hasn't criticized. Whether it be the JTCPOA, the arrangement with Russia, the arrangement with North Korea, anything. I mean, and he got played by Putin in Alaska.
Yep.
If you want to talk about the cost to Taiwan, it's done. The Chinese have watched us. We can't even put nails in crates of arms and send them abroad. The Chinese know now that we will never defend Taiwan with our blood. It is done. It is only a matter of when they can get there and make it least costly to themselves militarily and economically. And Trump and the Republicans gave that away. There is no case in which Trump, with this thing with the chips, if you wanted to do what Trump thinks he wants to do with Intel chips, you don't put a 10% tax. You don't take an equity stake. You flood the market because the argument is, if our chips are there, China won't go ahead and try to leapfrog us by developing their own. They're just awash in cheap chips. So if you believe what he wants to do, you don't take the stance that he's taken. Trump, as a negotiator, sucks. That's not to say he's not a brilliant politician and that he understands how to use the levers of power.
Right.
But again, as I've said economically, these levers of power that he's using, whether it be the aura around the presidency or the trust that the United States people put in the United States internally or abroad, he is selling the bolts off of our plane while we're in midair. We just haven't crashed yet.
But is he a bad negotiator for us, or is he a bad negotiator for himself, or both?
Well, I don't... He's a bad negotiator for the United States. There's no case. Even the deal that he cut with Europe, which, by the way, is far from finished. So we're not – when he says, I've got a trade deal and we're charging Europe 15%, they're years away from getting that really inked and signed. And the devil's in the details. It could be thwarted. And frankly, the Europeans are going to ride it out for 3.5 years and hope they get sanity on the other side of this. Now, as a politician, look, we've talked about the Trump playbook, right? Take a problem in real world, make it seem like it's horrible, whether it be crime in D.C., offer these vague solutions that nobody can really hold you to, and then when there's a tiny bit of improvement, 7 days of no murders in D.C., claim you're the one who did it. I mean, he's a brilliant as a politician, and we have an electorate in the United States that isn't well enough educated to understand what's been done to them yet. Let's hope they do before midterms. So he's lousy for the United States. He's a good politician. And obviously, by the way, the guys, as best we can tell, made millions of dollars off these meme coins and off of other schemes that no other American president would have ever engaged in.
I just echo what Mark says. I agree with him 100% here. But the other thing that's so fascinating to me about this administration is not only are they not very good at international relations, but they undercut themselves in ways that they haven't even foreseen yet. I mean, the cuts to USAID are going to affect our policy toward Asia for the next 50 years. And it was 50 years in the making to get Vietnam to be a robust ally, to get Taiwan to be a robust ally, to build up South Korea. And their left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. So it's not only he's a bad negotiator, but he's really bad at international systems.
Oh, and it's even, if you think about, let's think about Russia. We're now, I think, in the fifth month of we'll see in 2 weeks. So now if Trump ever does want to lower the boom on Putin and make it more expensive for him to continue to prosecute this war, whereas after the first 2 weeks expired, he'd have started to clip their wings, yeah, they would have believed him. Now that we're 5 weeks in, the punishment's going to have to be a lot more severe and actually start to risk issues around Putin's sustainability, potentially, which is somewhere we actually, as a united country, probably don't want to go. So Putin, actually, Trump, by continuing to give Putin more leash, is like a bad parent. He's the one who's now in the box. Trump is a horrible, this guy, again, if anyone asks you that question, let's just all practice. Trump sucks as a negotiator.
All right. Well, I can think of no better note to end the program on than just that. Feel free to make up your T-shirt, and we'll all wear them together the next time we meet. My thanks to all of you, Fran. It's a delight to hear your voice. Thank you very much. Good luck on the finishing up the book and all of that.
The best to everyone.
Thank you. Also, Bob Brigham, thank you for being here. Always good to see you.
Nice seeing you,
Catherine,
Joe. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And Mark Whitman, livened it up in the end. Thank you. Appreciate it. We'll be back. More roundtable in another hour coming up right after this.